When the world is threatened by product mediocrity, heroes rise to save the day with superhuman abilities in product management, design, and development. They battle to create a world filled with product excellence.
The Emperor does not share your optimistic appraisal of the situation.
These are the Chronicles of the Product Superheroes with your host, Bob Schoenthal. Huzzah!
All right. Hello, product people. So joining us today, we have a really great episode. We have Joseph Berg from Social Chorus, and he's going to be joining us to talk about metrics that we can test out.
Gaw.
Originally started at Blue Pumpkin as a product marketing manager. Then he became a senior product manager at Witness Systems, which bought out the Blue Pumpkin. Then became a director of product management at Model N. Then a senior director at Baynote, and then co-founded a company, Diamonds Are Dogs. Then became another senior director of product management at Tea Leaf, which was then acquired by IBM. And then now is the VP of product management at Social Chorus.
That's right.
A really great history, amazing history of product management. And so we're really honored to have you on the show today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So do you want to talk about what Social Chorus does?
Social Chorus is all about social advocacy, which means the brands that you love. If you love a sports team, a car brand, we're the ones that enable you to connect to the brand and then say really great things about them on social media. Like, I love the brand, love their latest product, great customer service. And this is priceless marketing and advertisement for the brand, which they really love for you to do.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Now, so, you know, with that huge history, you have kind of the history of working on, you know, startup products, you know, really early stage products, and it sounds like, you know, some larger scale products as well. So you really have the breadth of, you know, everything from, you know, beginnings to, you know, when it's a huge corporation. Kind of getting into the starting of a product, how do you start to measure something like that? So when you have the initial product planned, what's some of those initial measurements that you're looking at doing?
It's a great question. The initial product plan is usually just sort of an idea, and you don't really know what that idea is even going to look like. So it's hard to come up with measurements just yet. And my suggestion would be, don't. You want to come up with your idea. You want to just flesh it out a little bit, get people to start looking at it, and maybe even trying to use it, and then you'll figure out your measurements. Because if you start with the measurements, you're going to be forcing your product down a path that it may not need to go. For example, if Facebook had started out with a measurement of, I want people to be to have at least this many friends within a month. Okay, that may be a good measurement. It may not be. In fact, if you read Facebook's history later on, that turned out to be a pretty useful measurement. But they would have aimed for something different than the product they became. So don't start with the measurement. Start with the product, come up with an idea, experiment with it, see how people use it, then you'll know what to measure.
Now that makes a lot of sense, because if you, like you said, if you have a goal that's off someplace else, that might not be necessarily the goal you need to be getting to.
That's right.
You know, after you do some customer validation, you might find out, oh, the goal's actually over that and in the left direction.
That's exactly right.
So did you guys have to pivot a lot from your original business plan or model based on this?
At which company? Social Chorus?
At Social Chorus.
Yeah, absolutely. So Social Chorus originally started out as an agency, and then we said, no, a product would be much better. And then, you know, originally we started out when social advocacy was all about bloggers, mm-hmm. we built a product that was really meant for blogging.
Hmm. Okay.
And so our measurements were based on bloggers, like how many impressions of a blog post, click-throughs.
Right.
But as we saw the market develop, we had enough flexibility to go. And this is the mark of a great startup is that we're flexible.
You know,
fail fast. If something doesn't seem like it's working, try something else. You'll figure out what works and what doesn't. Just don't be too stuck to your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's the people who are very rigid and can't let go of their ideas are the ones that fail.
Right.
Because, you know, even if you have a great idea, you will need to make some changes to it as the market tells you what they think of your idea. So yeah, absolutely, we had to make changes at Social Chorus, but that's how we became successful, and we're doing really great the last year with, you know, the final version that we've reached.
Yeah, yeah, and I've actually witnessed that a lot, where I go to a lot of events and talk to a lot of founders, and you can always tell when they're completely stuck in their idea, when, you know, they're even when they have all of the metrics and the data showing that, you know, the customers really aren't interested in that. They're, you know, if you just pivot just a little bit over this direction, mm-hmm. you'll get, you know, mass appeal. But, you know, no, this is the way it has to be. It's my vision.
Yep.
And then, you know, a year later, they're still in the same place and
yep.
haven't grown any.
Now think about one of the most successful products, you know, for, you know, here's an example of the iPhone, right?
Yep. But
seems like, wow, Steve Jobs just came up with this thing, and right away it was an amazing success. But if you think about it, years ago he came up with something called, what, the Newton?
Yep.
Which Apple was Newton. This personal helper, sort of like an early version of the iPhone, and it was crap. Well, some people may disagree with that, but it certainly wasn't a success. Then he came up with the iPod, which, you know, took off, but really only as a music player. Mm-hmm. So in each iteration, he listened to the market, and sometimes he told the market what the market wanted,
right.
But in each case, he iterated on this many, many times before he came up with the first iPhone, and the first version of the iPhone was a success, but yeah. there was a long history of experiments leading up to that first iPhone.
Yeah, yeah, and I even remember after the iPhone came out, that there was that little bit of a wall because he wasn't allowing any third-party apps to
That's
get
right.
installed.
No app stores. And I mean, today we think of any smartphone as, wow, it's got to have an app store. But nobody remembers the fact that when the iPhone came out, I think it was only a year or maybe a year and a half later that the app store came out.
Yep.
So you experiment and you iterate, and he listened. And he was very, very adamant about no app store, no third-party applications. And then he listened to the market when the market said, Steve, you're wrong. You need third-party applications.
Yeah, because I think previous phones, like Nokia and all that, BlackBerry, they were all closed applications as well. So they weren't open to, you know,
That's
outside
right.
developers. So.
Yeah. So now say you have a product, you know, it's going good. You're several years into it. Now, how do you start to identify the key performance indicators? And do you have any, you know, a second question to that to add on is, do you have any special tools that you like using to measure those?
So the key thing is to understand what value your users are getting out of your product. So for example, for our product, the value that users, customers, which are brands, are getting out of our product is they get their advocates to share, consume, and create content, right? And it's interesting that we originally didn't think consumption of content was a value, and then we realized, wow, it is a value. So once you understand this, and once you understand that, wow, my product provides value through these three things, then figure out ways to measure these three things. So share is easy. Find out how many people are sharing stuff out of your platform. Find a way to measure that by integrating to all the social networks through their APIs and getting back all this information. Find out how many audience engagements each share has, because that's your amplification rate. Mm-hmm. So you want to find out a lot of information about share. Create. Great. Let's find out how many blog posts these people are creating, how many Instagram pictures they're taking and uploading, and then consumption. Let's find out how many clicks we're seeing on each piece of content that we're posting in the advocate experience, right? And I say this, and that's very unique to Social Chorus, but the theory of find out what your customers value and then measure that. So back to Facebook, for example, it turned out, and this is third-hand information, so please excuse me if this is incorrect, but the story I heard was that, you know, it turns out that people ended up valuing the number of friends, and any person who had more than 7 friends in the first week of being on Facebook would become a longtime user.
Yep.
Because they valued those social connections. That's what Facebook was enabling early on, was social connections.
Mm-hmm.
So they started measuring that.
Yeah.
Right. Now you don't want to get trapped into those measurements. So again, I'll take Facebook as an example. A lot of brands on Facebook thought that the value they had was people who looked at the brand's page. I like the brand's page, therefore the brand thought that was value. So they thought the like itself was the value. and they would go out and try to get more likes. But a lot of these likes were empty likes. They were likes that you were paying for, right?
Yeah,
you know, you put up some kind of like bait on Facebook saying, oh, look at this pretty picture of a baby riding a dinosaur. You know, like if you like babies riding dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And they were like, hi, I got 2,000 likes. Look at that. This is value I'm generating here. But it's empty value because that like was actually just a signal. It wasn't the actual value. The actual value was somebody is interested in you and wants to read your page. The like itself was just a signal of that. So don't confuse the signal of value with the real value.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, you using the Facebook example, you know, how many times have you gone just scrolling through, oh, like.
Exactly. And it's meaningless.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't even read the full article. You just read the headline, and you're like, oh, that's cool.
Right.
But then, you know, it's really the next step, the when you actually follow, so then you're getting the updates.
That's right.
That's when you actually take the action that's, you know, signaling them that, so, you know, hey, they're actually interested in you and reading everything that you're posting now, not just this, like you said, empty like that, you know, oh, okay, yeah.
That's right. Here's another great example, LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. How many times have you been endorsed for a skill on LinkedIn by somebody who has no way of knowing how you are at that skill, right?
Yep.
I got endorsed for product management by my wife's aunt. Great woman, highly intelligent. She knows nothing about my skills of product management. LinkedIn thought that their value is in providing crowd authenticated information about your professional career.
Mm-hmm.
So they started asking people, oh, will you endorse so-and-so for this skill?
Yeah.
But they did this too much, right? Yeah. So they present this to everybody now, and it's so easy to endorse that everybody's like, why wouldn't I endorse, right?
Yeah.
So they have diluted their value by making it too easy to add crowd-authenticated information about your skills. So make sure you understand your value and then measure that value and keep that value. That value is incredibly valuable.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in terms of Twitter, I've been kind of debating this one in my head because you have the follows on Twitter, which is you taking action and you're interested in what they have to say. But I always thought the more beneficial one was the retweet. You know, that you're actually grabbing their article and saying, oh, this is really great. I want my network to see this.
That's right.
So it causes that kind of ripple effect.
That's right. I absolutely agree with that because just having followers doesn't mean anything. Followers just means a lot of people might see your updates, and half of them are Twitter bots anyways.
Yeah.
A retweet means somebody was interested in your post and actually reshared it with their audience. Mm-hmm. So I think you're absolutely right. The measurement of value on Twitter is retweets.
Okay.
Maybe replies as well. I might add that as well.
Okay. And then, so you kind of touched on it before, or a little bit earlier here, but the difference between measuring things in a startup culture versus a corporation. So can you maybe expand on it a little bit more?
It really depends on the corporation. Most larger corporations are much more interested about just revenue, right? So mm-hmm. So they're less interested about, this is going to be a very broad generalization. So for people who might listen to this and go, my company's nothing at all like this, you're probably right. But a very broad generalization is once you get into a large company, you stop measuring the success of your product by individual product performance, and you just start measuring the success of your product by how much it gets sold.
Mm.
So you're building it to be sold as opposed to you're building it to provide value. And that's a very subtle distinction there because in order to be sold, it has to provide value, right? So I'm not saying big companies build worthless things, but they are building things that their sales force can sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very different from a company that's just out to build a valuable product. I'm not saying either one of those is right, by the way, because, for example, there's a lot of startups that fail because they try very hard to build a great product without thinking about who the heck is going to pay for this product, right? So they never come up with a business model.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that the shift from a small product to a large product in many cases is that shift from we'll just focus on building a great product to we'll focus on making money.
Mm. Yeah.
And so when you get to a large company, you focus a lot less on measuring the success of your product via very small indicators to measuring just revenue. Now, that's changing, by the way. So a lot of modern large companies like a Google, like a Facebook, like a LinkedIn do still try to measure very specific product-specific KPMs or KPIs, excuse me. But like I said, it varies from company to company.
Yeah, yeah, and I, you know, kind of touching on that, you know, I've been really getting into the lean methodologies lately, and one of the things that they Eric Ries really touches on is the vanity metrics versus actionable metrics. And I think that that's, you know, where those larger companies are failing, because revenue tends to be a vanity metric, because it could be a certain spike, maybe a certain ad went out that everyone got attracted to and start buying it, but it's not necessarily an indicator of the success of the product.
That's right.
It's, you know, the success of that ad that went out.
Right. Revenue is a decent indicator, but it's not directly correlated to how good your product is, right? You could just have a really great sales force. That said, there's nothing wrong with building a product that sells well.
Yeah.
I mean, as a product person, I want to build a great product. But as a business person, which a product person has to be a good business person, I want to build a product that sells well and makes money. So you got to focus on both. But I do agree with you that revenue is a vanity indicator, and that you should be looking at other indicators to determine the true value of the product.
Excellent.
Don't forget revenue, though.
Never forget revenue.
That's right.
That pays the bills. It keeps
That's
the lights
right.
on. So now, kind of shifting gears here, how would you, instead of measuring the success of the product, how do you measure your personal success as a product person?
I think you measure your personal success by the success of your product. Your goal, and this I teach this when I occasionally do teach product management classes, and I tell everybody that the goal of a product manager is to, and people use different language here, it's whether it's discover or reveal or build, but whatever language you use, it's you need to provide a winning product. And a winning product means a lot of different things, but a winning product means something that provides value, something that makes money. There are a lot of things that have to do with what a winning product is, but that is your job. That is your job as a product manager, is to provide that winning product. And I try to tell folks that, you know, unless you're in a nonprofit, which actually, even for nonprofits, this is true, but people pay you to provide value, right? You get a job to provide value. They're not paying you because they like you, because they enjoy your company. I mean, hopefully they do.
Yeah.
Hopefully you're working at a office that's fun to work at. But ultimately, you have this job because you are providing value.
Mm-hmm.
You provide more value than your salary and overhead combined, or else you're not worth keeping.
Yep.
How do product managers provide value? They provide value by building a winning product. That's it. That is what product managers do. Now, there's a lot that goes into a winning product, like communication, rollout documentation, roadmaps. There's not just the features and measurements, but that's your job. That's how your value is measured. So you better be providing a winning product.
Yeah. I find a lot of people wanting to get into product management tends to have that dreamy view of it.
Yeah.
That, you know, oh, it's all about just going in and thinking of new, you know, features and pushing it out to the developers,
right.
And, you know, yay, I won. But as you said, there is a lot more to it, you know, like the road mapping, the monitoring
right.
of metrics. Sometimes it's even, you know, getting it out and hitting the street. And, you know, I've known I had to kind of follow along with like sales teams to provide the demos for the sales teams.
That's right. Yeah, a product person is also a salesperson. You know, the three best qualities for a product manager is, one, technical. You need to understand the product. You don't need to be an engineer, but you do need to understand the product.
Yep.
Two, business. You don't need to be a sales or marketing person, but you need to understand the business of the product, how it's sold, how it's marketed, and then three, communications.
Yeah.
You got to be good at all three of those things, and you have to be involved in all of those things. If you think product management is just about spending day-to-day with engineers and coming up with cool features, you're horribly, horribly wrong.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of people I talk to that have that dream, you know, I say one of my first mistakes I ever made as a product manager was I built things that I thought were cool.
Right.
And it turned out to be a failure because it was not the things that the customers wanted. And really, you know, it's the customers that are going to drive you to the innovation.
Right.
You know, you have to sit down with them, do some customer service, get, you know, one-on-one with them, figure out what their pain points are, and start building off of that.
Right. And sometimes you can be ahead of your customers. Again, not to use not to overuse the iPhone example, but who would have thought that we needed a mini computer in our pockets with a touch screen that also make calls, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
there was nobody that was asking for that. In fact, Palm tried to do that a couple of years before the iPhone, and they failed because everybody went, that's a clunky-looking phone.
Right.
So, you know, you can be visionary. You don't just need to listen to your customers, but you do need to at least pay attention to what they're doing and what they're saying.
Yeah.
Right? So you can be visionary. You can be ahead of your customers. You can tell them what they want instead of just listening to what they want. But you still also have to listen. You can't just be the visionary.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a CEO that was very much like that. She would always say, the customers don't know what they want until we give it to them. And there is truth in that because, a lot of times customers will get into a certain box of thinking and they don't realize that, technology has advanced and we could add these really cool features.
And I learned very early, even before I even got into product management, my first job was when I was 16 and I worked retail at a Kmart, right? Yeah. I learned very early on that the old adage that the customer is always right is 100% wrong.
Yeah.
Not 100%, somewhat wrong, right?
Yeah.
It's not the customer is always right. The customer is sometimes right, sometimes wrong. Mm-hmm. Just like you, the visionary, is sometimes right, sometimes wrong. So the right place to be is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah,
listen to your customers. Don't just assume they're right, but also don't just assume they're wrong. Sometimes you'll have a great idea that the customers haven't told you about, and that's perfectly valid.
All right. Now, getting on to, because you work with a product management team.
Correct.
My previous positions, it was, you're it. you're the product guy, go. So when you're on a team and you're actually managing a team, how are you gauging your team's performance?
So that... It depends on the type of function each one of them is performing. Mm. I will say that it's very different to go from a product manager to a manager of product managers. And I think that's true whenever you become a manager of any team, is you really have to realize a few things. One, your success means their success and vice versa. So you have to make them successful. You have to make your team successful. Two, you can't do their job for them. You have to teach them how to do their job, because a lot of people have the tendency to be like, oh, you're not doing this right, let me do it for you. Right? That's a really horrible way to manage, because one, you're discouraging your employee, and two, you are not teaching them how to do this better, which means you will always have to do their job for them, which means you will never scale as a manager. If you want to scale as a manager, you have to teach them how to do their job. You have to put processes in place that help them do their job. And then you have to step back and let them do their job, even if they end up doing it in a way that you wouldn't have done it. Yeah. You're not always right. And in fact, in many cases, it turns out that your employees know more than you do. And that's great. It is wonderful to have employees that are more talented than you because, as I said before, their success is your success. Yeah. So all of a sudden, you've extended your talents through your team. So back to your original question of how do you measure people, I typically measure specifically product managers by the output of PRDs. At Social Course, we call them PRDs, product requirement documents. They're called FRSs or specs. There's
MRDs.
MRD is typically a larger sort of strategic document, whereas PRD is more tactical. But yes, there's a dozen names for them that I can think of. So I look at their performance by their output of PRDs. The content, obviously, of those PRDs. From a PRD, they tend to write stories. So what kind of stories are they writing for production by development?
Like user stories for the Agile?
That's right. Okay. We're an Agile shop, so they have to write stories based on their PRDs. And then the communication of those releases to the broader team, the services team, the solutions team, the customer success team, the sales team, the marketing team, and so on. So it's basically the entire product development cycle. I want to make sure that they own it beginning to end. I will assign them a project, a piece of functionality. They go do it. At other companies, I've had product managers that specifically own a piece of the product. So rather than being project-based, where I give them a project and they run with it, they actually own, like if you have a team and you have seven applications, you'll have one product manager on each application. Right? So that's another way of doing it. But you want to give them ownership of something beginning to end so they can come up with the idea, flesh it out, do the marketing requirements, do their market research, work with the UI folks, design it, put it together with PRD, write stories, and release it, right? You want to give them that sense of ownership beginning to end. And you measure them by how successful those features are and by how well they did throughout the whole process.
Great. Great. Yeah, when you're talking about becoming a manager, one of the first times I became a manager, it triggered this management seminar I went to. And one of the analogies that, you know, because every seminar you go to, there's those little nuggets that you pull out.
Sure.
And the one of the nuggets I pulled out was an analogy that was kind of about what you were saying there. And she was talking about when you're managing, think of, you know, you're walking past all of your employees, and each one has screaming little monkeys. And if you go up to them, they're going to want to throw that monkey on your back. And by the time you get back to your desk, you're going to have 12 screaming monkeys scratching and clawing at you, and you're not going to be able to focus on anything. So what you need to do is take the monkey, say, this is how you handle this monkey, and then hand it back to them.
That's right.
And then by the time you get back to your desk, you have no monkeys, and there you have that knowledge of how to handle that now.
So, that's right. It's a great analogy.
Maybe, it made me think of that. I was like, oh. So let's see here. Now, for aspiring product managers, because product management has been really booming lately. Sure. I noticed that it's become the new hot thing everyone wants to get into. For an aspiring product manager, do you have any advice on how to get into it?
So as I said before, you need to be three things. You need to be technical enough to understand the product you want to work on. You need to be business-oriented enough to understand the business of how it's sold and marketed. And you need to be a good communicator. So work on all three of those skills. Find ways on your resume to prove that you have all three of those skills. So if you don't have a computer, this, by the way, a lot of my answers are going to be based on the fact that I'm in high tech and in software, right? So for other fields, this may be different. But if you're trying to get into product management and software and you don't have a computer science degree, then, you know, go study, go spend 12 weeks doing Code Academy courses and Udemy courses and whatever, deploy a couple of apps to Heroku, get a GitHub account, and look at that. That on your resume proves to me that you have technical savvy. If you have an engineering background and you have no business savvy or no way to show that, then do the opposite. Start a side business. Do something. Do something that will make me understand on your resume that you have all three of those skills, because all three of those skills need to be evident on your resume. And then finally, what you need to do is get domain knowledge. Mm-hmm. Whatever domain you want to go into, if you want to be a product manager for gaming or for content or for social or for mobile or for big enterprise, whatever domain you want to get into, you need to be an expert. Unless you're going for a very, very junior product management role, you want to be the expert at that domain. You want to be the domain expert, which is why, by the way, it's very, I don't want to say very easy. It's much easier to get into a product management job by transferring inside the company you're already in. Yep. Because you already know the company. You already know their customers, the sales process, and so on. And so transferring to product management, you've got the domain knowledge. They just need to teach you how to be a product manager. And that can be done.
Yep. That's actually how I got my first product management role was I was doing managing the customer service area. And then eventually became a trainer for the software and learned the software in and out so detailed. And then because I was training the agents that were using the software, I got to know them and what their needs were and all the questions that were popping up during the class. And then it just slowly but surely built my expertise in that domain. Right. And then so it was just a natural choice for them to say, oh, well, we need a product manager. You know everything about the product now. You know the customers. You're going out there and learning everything about the real estate industry for the product. Why not do it?
That's exactly right. That's very similar to how I started out in product management as well. And then today, I see a lot of people who come to my product management classes, and they say, "Oh, I'm thinking about quitting my job so I can go try to find a different job as a product manager." And that is a horrible mistake. Yeah. Don't quit your job. Try to get a product management job within the company you're at. It's a great way to get started in product management.
And what would you say is the success rate for people who are just applying directly through websites or just sending out mass emails of their resumes?
If you're just sending out mass emails, then your success rate is pretty low, right? Yeah. You can get a job by sending out a resume. I'm not saying you can't, but do a little bit extra work, mm-hmm. right? I had somebody who sent me a resume, and I looked at it, and I'm like, okay, well, nothing special about it, so I'll put it away. A week later, my CEO came up to me and said, hey, this guy just reached out to me. He said he'd be really good for the product management job here, and would you mind taking a look at him? Same guy. And still the same resume.
Right.
But it was interesting. You know, look at what he did. He had the courage and he had the communication skills to reach out to my CEO and say, hey, would you mind going to your VP of product management and convincing him to give me a chance?
Right.
That got him a chance.
So basically just kind of taking that extra step or...
You either have something good on your resume that makes you look great, or do all the extra work to make me think you're great.
Right.
Right. So if your resume is amazing, you've got the CS degree and you're a founder and, you know, you've got some business sense already and you've got some great communication skills that you're showing me on your resume, you've got domain knowledge, great. I'll give you a chance.
Yeah.
If you don't have all those things, don't just send out mass emails. Right. Mass emails are a great way to just get rejected right away.
Yeah.
Do the extra work. Reach out to me on LinkedIn saying, hey, I noticed you have an open position. If you can't even bother to do the research of saying this company is hiring product managers, let me find out who their VP of product management is and reach out to him specifically. Do that work. If you can't even do that work, your resume is not going to stand out from the other 50 that I'm just seeing this week.
Right.
Yeah. Now, another trick that I always hear is, you know, along the lines of doing the work, you know, for one, putting into the cover letters of, you know, hey, I went through your product. Here's some core elements
That's
that
right.
I think, you know, could be improved. And then even doing like a PRD or, you know, some mock-ups or something to that extent that says, you know, hey, these are, you know, things that, you know, I noticed that, you know, could fix on your product.
That's exactly right. I can't emphasize enough that you need to show that you're interested. Just sending in a resume. There's 50 other people sending in a resume that week. You better have something amazing on your resume if you expect to stand out that way. So back to your point, we were hiring for a graphic designer, UI designer last year. And, you know, there's a lot of UI designers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they all sent in their resume. One guy took a look at our login page and sent in, hey, here's how I would redesign it.
Mm.
And then that's the person that we hired.
Yeah.
Because he went the extra mile. And he actually showed me right away that he knew how to do the work.
Right.
And I went, oh, wow, this is amazing. This looks great. Not exactly how I would have done it. But, hey, you know what? He's the graphic designer, not me, so he knows better.
Yeah.
And he did the work. And we ended up hiring him.
Great. Now I noticed on your LinkedIn page, you have a PowerPoint there of kind of how to get a job as a product manager.
That's the class I teach. I teach it occasionally at General Assembly. I've also done a presentation at Silicon Valley Product Management Association. But that's the class I teach about what is product management, what do you need in order to be a product manager, what's a good way to start. A lot of the topics that we've covered here so far are covered in that presentation and in those classes.
Okay. So that's a great resource for people to check out. They can kind of hop to your page.
Sure.
You know, check out that PowerPoint, and then hopefully, if you teach it, are you teaching any classes in the future?
I just taught the General Assembly class again last week.
Okay.
So probably won't be teaching it again for another 3 or 4 months. We mentioned before the recording started, I've got a 9-month-old at home, which doesn't leave me much time to do speaking engagements and teach classes these days.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we were able to get you out here for this. All right. So do you have any final thoughts for our audience?
Only that to be successful, and this is something I think we covered a little bit earlier, to be successful as a product manager, you need to love your product. You need to take it personally. If you're not taking your product personally, you're not going to be successful. That's number one. Take it personally. It's your product. Have pride in it. You are the cheerleader for your product, the evangelist, whatever you want to call it. You are the one that needs to tell people, this product is amazing, even when you know it has some flaws. If you ever find yourself telling people, oh, my product sucks, you should find a different job because you're awful at being a product manager for that product. And that happens sometimes. Maybe you've been at a company too long and you've gotten burnt out and you no longer have faith in that company. But if you find yourself getting to that stage, you either need to change or you need to change your job.
Yep.
So that's number one. Number two is remember that it's more than just the product itself. So in software, obviously, there's nothing physical, but there's still the product. And then there's all the surrounding things like sales enablement, training, documentation. roadmap, all of those things are part of your product. And a lot of product managers ignore those. They think to themselves, I just need to provide a great product, and I'm done. Just build the features, and that's all I need to do. And you are wrong. You need to also provide the planning, the roadmap, the known issues document, the how-to document, the benefits document. All of those things are part of providing a winning product.
Yeah.
So I think those two points, if you keep them in mind, you will be a great product manager.
Yeah, yeah. And one of those, that final point there, one of the ways I tend to think of it is, if you were to leave the company, does the company have all of that knowledge, you know, built up so it can be handed to someone else and still be a successful product? You know, so make sure that, you know, all of your documents are there, everything's outlined, because, you know, you could get hit by a bus.
Oh, yeah, but it's going to save you work later on. If you do a good job documenting that PRD, that PRD becomes your documentation. And guess what the documentation does? It answers questions, which otherwise you'll need to answer, right? Because if you don't build good documentation, people will come to you and say, how do I use this? If you don't support the product marketing person with competitive information, salespeople are going to come to you and ask, hey, how are we different from our competitor? If you don't support the salespeople with a good roadmap, they'll sell stuff. They will sell stuff that you're not planning to build, and that'll get you in trouble. So you're providing all of this supporting material, both because it's part of a winning product, but also to protect yourself, to prevent yourself from having to do extra work later on. Again, it's a way of leveraging your time and making yourself more efficient.
All right. Now, is there a way people can reach out to you?
The easiest way is just through LinkedIn. Okay. There's only one Gal Josephsberg. Are you going to add that in the podcast, my name?
Yeah.
So spell it out for them, because most people don't spell it correctly. So I think there's only one Gal Josephsberg in the entire world, as far as I know of.
Wow. I found out that there is one other Bob Schoenthal. He tends to go by Robert Schoenthal. But
right. There's only one other G. Josephsberg, in fact, in the entire world. And sometimes we compete for who gets that screen name on whatever new service comes out. So, yeah, the easiest way is just to find me on LinkedIn, reach out through LinkedIn, connect, or just send a message.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Gal, for being with us today. Really great, great knowledge. So we really appreciate having you.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
All right, thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
This has been an episode of Product Superheroes, and we thank you for joining us. You can check out more episodes on either productsuperheroes.com, or we are syndicated on the Global Product Management Talk, ProdMGMTTALK.com, where you can find this show among several other great shows. You can also check out startupproduct.com for information on some great meetups and training sessions coming in the near future. We also love hearing from our listeners, so if you have any questions, comments, or know of a product superhero we should have on, please reach me at bob@productsuperheroes.com or on Twitter at Mighty Bobarian, MightyBobarian. Thanks, everybody, and remember, if you don't love what you build, how the heck will anyone else?